Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
You know, as a producer, any company or organization that you're involved with, or anyone that you possibly purchase an input from, or whether that be crop protection tools, data, equipment, or maybe you're a member of the wheat growers, or you're a member of the corn growers, or American soybean, or the sorghum, national sorghum producers. We are all there basically in one room where, and we also have educational sessions. Each of the organizations have meetings there. We all have a booth.
Chandler Gould, CEO, National Association of Wheat Growers.
Next year is also going to be the National Association of Wheat Growers' 75th anniversary. And so we're going to have a big to-do at our booth there, celebrating the 75 years of representing the wheat growers at the Commodity Classic in Denver, Colorado, that first weekend in March.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
www.cubacouncil.org.
John Kavalik is president of the U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council.
And everything on our website is free for, you know, ag interests. And, you know, that's something that we started to do. And we were behind the what remains to date the largest food and ag exhibition in Cuba in 2002, because basically the one bright spot, the one consistent bright spot since December of 2001, when the first agricultural commodities and food products went from the U.S. to Cuba under this TISRA law, it's about $7.5 billion in agricultural commodities and food products that have been exported from the U.S. to Cuba on a cash-only basis, because that's what the law requires. And Cuba generally ranks in the 50s of usually 220, 230 global export markets for the U.S. And that's extraordinary. And, you know, when the law was passed in 2000, there were, you know, some of the ag groups were critical, were critics, because they said, hey, cash only will mean we can't give payment terms. Banks can't finance for Cuba. We're going to sell less. And the companies, the exporters themselves, through the council, were very clear. And they said, look, no matter how well-intentioned Cuba is, because of its chosen commercial, economic, and political policies, it's chronically late in paying everyone, even with the best of intentions. So at some point, if we allow payment terms or financing, they're going to default. And no U.S. CEO wants to go on CNBC and be asked the question, why did you, you know, finance $25 million in exports to Cuba and now they've defaulted? So what the company said is, look, we'd rather have John be able to go on television and radio and in print and say, Cuba is the safest export market in the world for U.S. companies, which is true because it's all cash. But that $7.5 billion, it's a massive number and it's a great number. So, you know, the ag data is something that we do every month, and we've been doing it every month since December of 2001, when the first rice and corn went to, and poultry went to Cuba. And, you know, we find that the ag interests, you know, they use that data. So so that's, you know, our website, we have the Economic Eye in Cuba, which is basically just gives a lot of what's happening. Of course, in the last 2 years, the most momentous change was by the Biden administration allowing the first license for the direct investment and direct financing into a Cuban private company. And this was a huge change. And of course, we still wait for the Cubans to issue the regulations allowing the money to go in. So, you know, I'm looking to put a bag over my head. You know, it's just so astonishing.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
What's going to happen to U.S. domestic FAME and RD production is going to have a lot to do with whether 45Z is implemented.
What is the outlook for U.S. biofuels? University of Illinois ag economist Scott Irwin.
Because whether we're going to slow down those imports or not depends on whether we get 45Z. So my bottom line is the outlook for 2025 depends crucially on 45Z implementation because of an expected impact on imports. My outlook is with 45Z, domestic production for RD and FAME is going to go up about 10%. Without it, I don't see any reason for it to change. And, of course, everything was thrown up in the air a little over a week ago with a Reuters article that said the Biden administration was not going to finalize clean fuel tax credit guidance. Don't know what's going to happen. And, of course, that's you can see the stakes that I just demonstrated for this market. Very recent news items are a little bit more optimistic about 45Z at least being initially implemented this year. But exactly what's going to happen is really anybody's guess at this point in time.
Then there's the potential for trade wars.
President-elect Trump has announced plans to impose 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico and an additional 10% tariff on goods from China. And coming the other direction, we know within biofuels, there's a lot of political pressure to impose punitive tariffs on RD feedstock imports, particularly UCO from China. The idea that renewable fuels should be American-made, that intersects with the downturn in the ag economy. So maybe we'll get a possible exclusion of imported feedstock from 45Z eligibility or a revised blender's tax credit. Again, huge uncertainty. Lastly, important to point out that the tit-for-tat reaction of other countries to the imposition of new tariffs is very unpredictable and can set off damaging economic chain reactions. And we have a recent example of that in soybeans. This chart shows the export price in orange of soybeans from New Orleans or NOLA in the U.S. versus the main port in Brazil in 2014 through 2019. And here is when the U.S.-China trade war began and a wedge between Brazilian soybean export prices, the U.S. opened up, got as large as $2.50 a bushel, kind of got bailed out by the African swine fever epidemic in China, which reduced their demand for soybeans and basically made U.S. and basically drove Brazilian prices back down to the lower U.S. soybean price. But this shows how dramatic the trade war impacts can be on market prices and unpredictably so. So with that, I know that's a lot. Let me conclude by saying simply the outlook for RD and FAME biodiesel is incredibly uncertain going forward. Biggest uncertainty is how the new Trump administration will approach the setting of RVOs for 26 through 28. Implementation of 45Z tax credit is another major source of uncertainty, and I'll end up simply by saying, I wish I could be more specific in outlook, but policy markets like RD and FAME are most uncertain when policy is highly uncertain.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, I think it is a big factor as we think of our cattle feeding industry in the panhandle. That's where all the growth in our dairies have been.
Dr. David Anderson is a Texas A&M AgriLife Extension livestock economist talking about the tight cattle supplies and the beef on dairy.
So now we have over 600,000 dairy cows in the state. The vast majority of them are in the Texas panhandle. And so as this change has been made, this beef on dairy, all of a sudden, you know, we've got a lot more dairy cows. And what we have through this is a lot more a growth in the number of feeder cattle available that are coming from dairies. And as we think about the seasonality of that production, dairies are having calves all the time. And so I think we have feedlots that are able to tap into a more constant stream of feeder cattle, and those, you know, given the growth in that trend, you know, we certainly would see that. And then I think, like in other cattle, there are advantages to feeding the same animals together. So we have these beef on dairy cattle, and so we have feedlots that are tapped into that stream of animals, and so you may very well see yards that have a lot of those and being fed together.
Now, one difference with the beef on dairy cross, they stay on feed longer.
Well, I think it's probably fair to say we feed them longer in a feedlot setting. Because we think about, they come from a dairy, you know, you got this day-old calf, and they go to a calf ranch, and they're raised there. Whereas, you know, in sort of our regular, normal, conventional beef cow systems, those calves are out on the range to begin with. They show up at a feedlot, sometime at a variety of weights, either calf feds or feeder weights. And we could think about those, the beef on dairy calves coming from a little different production system. So depending on how we define the feeding period, when are they on a feedlot, or, you know, when are the, did they go to the feed yard versus the calf ranch and that feeding system? I'm not sure how I would define that, but, you know, we probably would think about them being on feed longer, and that probably contributes to our growing number of days on feed for cattle in feedlots. That's part of some changes we've seen in recent years, months.
But as we ring in a new year, a lot has changed over the past 20.
Well, you know, 20 years ago, I'd have to go back to look at the statistics, but that was pretty close to where there were no dairy cows in the Texas Panhandle. They were all in the Stephenville, the east of Dallas, Sulphur Springs area. So that is a huge change. But I will say, I got a colleague, Joe Outlaw. You probably know Joe. Joe and I wrote a paper at a conference, at a dairy conference, and this had to be 25, 30 years ago, at least 25. I hate to talk about things that far out, but our topic was, where's the next growth area? Because in the dairy industry, we always had these growth areas. This was the new booming hot dairy production area. And in that paper, we made a couple of suggestions. Basically the Southern Plains, Texas Panhandle, you know, Western Kansas, Eastern Colorado, that Southern Plains growth area was one of them. And the other one was South Dakota and North Dakota, and we're starting to see growth there as well. So I guess our crystal ball looked pretty good way back then. Not good enough for us to invest, but good enough for us to write the paper.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think on the legal side, we think of contract risk and policy risk, and I've written in several places about the fact that policy itself is somewhat of a risk because there's so much uncertainty.
Brad Lubin is a policy specialist with the University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
We obviously have uncertainty right now about a farm bill and whether we might get one done or whether we might yet face another extension. But we're talking about an uncertain future as to what does the farm bill look like and what does the safety net look like. That creates challenges for producers thinking about how to manage risk in the coming year. We also then have similar risks about other policies. And so producers are always faced with the reality of we have to manage for today's environment. We also have to position our operation to either be ready for opportunities that might come in the future or be ready for shocks or challenges that might come in the future. So you're almost managing for the risk that doesn't yet exist, because the possibility is there that in the legal framework, the policy framework, we might have to address that soon enough.
Then there's a human risk.
I note that it's overlooked in the sense it's easy to look at the markets every day or to look at the field and think about production every day. And the financial questions are certainly in front of us now almost every day too. You can think about those decisions that happen every single day. And then you get to the people side and you say, well, the people resources are what I do every day. I've got tasks to do. I've got chores to do. I've got fires to put out, right? That's the kind of thing that just consumes us day to day. And yet we don't forget about the human resource is perhaps the most valuable asset we have on the operation. And it is fundamentally why the operation exists. It's the people. So if you don't figure out not only how to manage today's chores and tasks, but also how to manage the people involved in that operation, that can be the downfall of the entire operation, regardless of its financial position or its productivity and its competitive success. If you can't manage the people, ultimately you don't have much of an operation to work with. That's hired personnel. So the traditional personnel management, job descriptions, all the tools you might think of about how to better manage people, how to find them, how to train them, how to retain them, you know, how to motivate them. Those are all important elements of managing people. That's also true if those people aren't hired, if they're your family. And amongst other things, you generally can't fire your family. So you're dealing with how do I work with family communications? And then there's one more element of this too yet that shows up there in the human risk side. It's ultimately the transition of the operation, retirement planning, succession planning, farm transition, et cetera. Nobody, almost nobody, expects to die in the next year. But we all have in that 5 to 10 year window the reality that, hey, we've got to think about how to transition this operation. So it's often the things on the human risk side that they get overlooked on the day-to-day because they're not tasks that have to be done today with a deadline, or they're bigger strategic questions that still get overlooked year to year because that may not happen this year, but they're critical to ultimately the success of the operation, the viability, the future path, and that includes personal well-being. As we go through some financial challenges here, we note that personal stress and family stress and communications all suffer, and managing that and recognizing that and admitting that is an important part of dealing with the risks that we face.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
This is the supply and demand setup that I've used for a number of years in explaining the operation of the RD and FAME markets.
In our recent webinar looking at the outlook for U.S. biofuels, FAME biodiesel, and renewable diesel, University of Illinois ag economist Dr. Scott Irwin
shows a standard supply curve and then a perfectly horizontal or perfectly elastic demand curve for either RD or FAME, and that demand curve is horizontal at the price of petroleum diesel, because RD and FAME compete directly for ULSD gallons. And so this is a conceptual framework. It's obviously not a perfect representation. But the key and simplest point to note is, why is this a policy market? The answer is, without policy incentives, there's no market. RD and FAME, we're going back to that price chart, are expensive enough that without policy incentives, the equilibrium quantity is zero. The supply and demand curves do not cross in the positive quadrant for price and quantity, thus policy market. So let's now ask, what happens with this chart when we add an RFS volume mandate? So here's the volume mandate, the red vertical line. I'm calling that QM. Quantity mandate. So by law, we cannot use less than the QM in the US RD and FAME markets. That's what a mandate means. Well, if RD and FAME are so expensive to produce, how does the market get that job done? Because in order to produce QM, the price for RD needs to be the supply price that intersects at the mandate level. So here's our supply price right here. Well, consumers don't care. They say, we're only going to pay for RD at the price of petroleum diesel. That's the demand price. Something has to make up the difference, and that is the RIN, which is the supply price minus the demand price. The key for our present purposes is, though, that this whole system works to make QM the demand ceiling that I talked about earlier. Conceptually, this is where it comes from. It's also where the idea of the RIN cliff comes from. If you produce beyond QM for some potentially irrational reason, then the RIN value crashes theoretically to zero. But again, the key point from this chart is that with a volume mandate in a policy market, the mandate sets the max demand in the market. Now we want to layer on top of that another policy. In this case, the blender or biodiesel tax credit. All that that does is move the demand price and demand curve up by the amount of the biodiesel tax credit. It doesn't have 1 gallon influence on the max demand in the marketplace. All that the tax credit does is change who pays what. It just lowers the RIN value that in essence represents the cost to consumers, and the tax credit is the cost to taxpayers. It's just changing, dividing up who's paying.
University of Illinois ag economist Dr. Scott Irwin. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, I think a lot of them moved in from California, particularly.
One of the fastest growing regions for dairy production, West Texas. Texas A&M's David Anderson.
You know, as land costs went up there, feed costs and things, I think there's a number of attributes of the Southern Plains that are that have been very attractive. One is land availability, the ability to grow feed on that land. And so, you know, that right there allowed you to move from say over there to here and vastly expand. Because you're in the Southern Plains and the Panhandle Southern Plains region, an arid region, I think that lends some help in terms of, you know, environmental permitting and things like that. It was also a region that's very used to confined animal feeding. We had feedlots everywhere, and so that part was nothing new as well. And so I think a lot of those fueled growth in that region and some movement from Central Texas too out there. And so you just had a lot of conditions, economic conditions, and that made it a good place to move to, at least a promising area, and certainly has seen a huge amount of growth.
Now, while per capita consumption of milk continues to decline, dairy continues to grow.
We're consuming basically more milk than ever before, but we consume it in different forms, right? Instead of drinking it in fluid form, as you noted, our per capita consumption has been declining there for many years. We eat more cheese. We eat more pizzas, you know. So we're getting our dairy products, but we're getting them in different forms. So pizza is one, you know, with cheese on it. Butter per capita consumption has been increasing for a number of years. And I think that follows a trend of sort of this pendulum away from, you know, gosh, you know, don't eat fat, fat's bad. But it turns out what we replace that with might have been worse. And so we've moved back to more, I'm going to say more natural, like butter. I mean, what's your ingredients in butter? It's milk. And so we see increasing per capita consumption of cheese, of a variety of different cheeses, butter. We certainly had the boom several years ago in Greek-style yogurts. We've got a bunch of these dairy products that really have been booming. And then if you go to, you know, I think you mentioned byproducts. So, you know, remember your nursery rhyme, Little Miss Muffet sat on her tuffet eating her curds and whey. Well, the curds are the cheese and the whey is the byproduct. Yet whey is a high-protein product. And those other milk protein products go into a huge variety of processed foods, and a heck of a lot of like weightlifter drinks and, you know, post-workout recovery things where we're looking for, and that matches this fad. Well, let's be careful. Let's not call it a fad. This trend, consumer trend towards consuming more protein. Well, those dairy products are a great dairy protein that fuels into that consumer desire for higher protein diets, and whey protein is part of that.
And then there's the growth in the cheese industry.
If you're going to have a big growth in milk production, you've got to have a growth in processing that goes hand in hand with that. And because milk's a perishable item, right? And if our per capita consumption of fluid milk is declining, we got to have processing capacity relatively nearby to handle that. And so we have the growth in this whole industry, not just the cows and the milk, but now the processing that that milk goes into, that really goes into a national and international market for dairy products.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Yeah, actually, in the history of our country, we've never passed the Farm Bill in an election year, presidential election year.
Co-director of the Ag and Food Policy Center at Texas A&M back in September.
You know, there's a window after the election before the Congress turns over. I just don't think that, well, I just point to history, and we've never been able to do that time period either. So I truly believe that the Farm Bill will move into early next year. I think probably, and this is news to a lot of people, but I think probably some sort of what I call financial disaster assistance will be passed this year. Much more likely for that to happen than the Farm Bill to get done. And that will be immediate relief within the next, you know, few months for people who are suffering because of these low prices and high input costs that they're dealing with.